Anybody here tired from so much to do? Anybody here that feels like if they had a little bit more time, they could do a better job? Perhaps all of us. So anyway, I want you to try to think about what I'm going to talk about today as I go along here, speaking in a parable. I haven't always been, and I won't always be. Right now, I'm on the move. And as I move, I'm measuring out life. People wait for me. People submit to me. Sometimes they actually fear me. Most people think I'm on the move forever, but I'm not. There's no one who will ever stop me but God. But when he does stop me, that will be it for all of you. Then it'll be too late to forgive your brother, too late to forgive your sister, be too late to apologize to others, too late to do good, too late to make a difference, too late to visit a sick friend, too late to help that someone in need, too late to repent, too late to make the changes we would have wished we would have made. There's coming a point when I will end, and when I come to my end, you go with me into eternity. It's about time. That's what I'm talking about, isn't it? I'm talking about time. It's about time for all of us, if you'll let me say it that way, and that's what the sermon is about today. Someone said this one time, and that God created time, they said, so that everything wouldn't happen all at once. That's kind of an interesting thought. Let's go over to 2 Peter, if you will. But God isn't bound by this physical life the way that you and I are. He's not bound, as it were, by time. He lives, actually, inside and outside of time. 2 Peter 3 and verse 8, familiar scripture, says this. But, beloved, be not ignorant of this one thing, that one day is with the Lord as a thousand years, and a thousand years as one day. And so you see a God who isn't constrained by time. I mean, I remember the case of Jesus Christ when he had to ascend to his Father, and he said, don't touch me because I haven't ascended to my Father yet. But he ascends to the Father, goes back to heaven, and returns that afternoon. But I want you to think about this. Can you imagine what would have happened when he would have gone back to heaven? God is inside and outside of time. He can go ahead and accomplish what would take a thousand years to accomplish in one day. And yet he's also able to take a thousand years to accomplish what you might want to accomplish in a day. So imagine now Christ going to heaven. Imagine the welcoming committees. You know, if it was here in the United States, why, we'd have huge parades. We'd have people converging from all over the universe, coming to meet him, reestablishing old acquaintances, congratulations, that kind of thing taking place, a ceremony for sure. And yet he's able to do that and come back in that very day, you see. I think very often we don't see this ability of God to live inside and outside of time. There was a case once, I remember, in a Bible study, a lady asked a question, what if I'm changed into a spirit being and my children aren't raised? And of course the answer is that God could be right there taking care of your child, and then you'd be able to go anywhere else in the universe and be back before that child ever knew you were even missing. That's the kind of power that God has when it comes to time. It's an amazing thing. Someday we'll be like that, and I think it's going to be wonderful, but I'll say this. It's not like that today, is it? It's nowhere near like that today. We are always out of time. Now, there was an excerpt from the LA Times where it was probably something like Irma Bombeck or some kind of article like that. I don't remember exactly where, but I did remember taking that article because it was so fascinating. And it started out like this by the writer. I started when I went to the dentist, he wrote. And they asked me, my dentist did, to start brushing my teeth. He said at least 4 minutes every time I did it. And I said, okay, I really should. So he wanted me to start brushing more and flossing more. And so I made a commitment, the article said, to start brushing and flossing more often. Then going to a medical exam, the doctor asked this question, how much did I exercise? Wanted to know if I monitored my salt intake. And so I could see that I had a fitness program that needed to be started. I was going to need to spend more time every day doing some exercise. Going to need to start monitoring my cholesterol. And so I needed a schedule to put together. And I went to the barber, of course, to get a haircut, and he says, boy, Art, your hair is really thinning. He said, you ought to take probably 4 or 5 minutes a day and massage your scalp. So I said, okay, you know, I'd make a commitment to do that and begin to massage my scalp more frequently. And then I had an appointment with the appliance repairman. Coffer maker wasn't working, and he said, well, you know, you need to run vinegar through these things about once a month, every day. Once a month, at least for one day, run some vinegar through this, and that'll you know, stop this from happening, and we'll get all clogged up and everything. So I said, okay, then we'll do that. Make sure I put that on my schedule, of course. Then I realized that wasn't the only thing that needed maintenance. Of course, there's the car that needs maintenance, and then the tape player wasn't working well, and they said, well, you got to clean the head every so often, and your tape player, you need to clean that up. Make sure that you do that periodically and on a regular basis. And then I realized this. Never understood this for a long time, but that your computer drive gets fragmented. And that every month you're supposed to defrag your computer. And I had no idea how long this took, so I sat there and watched the little pieces go into the box for about 2 hours. And then I went to bed, but they said, no, you need to do this all the time. You don't just wait for 6 months to do it, but this is something you should be doing every month. So I said, okay, I'll put that on my schedule. Then I realized that I had to clean my VCR. You see, the head on that gets a little dirty, and then you had to rotate the tires, and I began to wonder, does it ever stop? And then the last straw was this magazine, you see, that said this: you are endangering your family if you don't clean your smoke detectors on a regular basis. How do we keep up with it all? We can't, can we? You know, the point is this. We are scheduled out of existence sometimes. How can we have time to do everything we need to do? And so we don't. So I think what happens to most of us is we just manage by crisis, don't we? When we have to do the things, then we finally get around to doing them. But the world we live in today, you see, is a world of incredible irony. We have streamlined communication, instantaneous communication, that is, streamlined transportation. We're computerized, and we're going to save so much time from all of this. That's what they told us. Do you remember what they said when the computers were first coming out? This is going to eliminate all this paperwork. Oh no, it just generated more and more and more paperwork. Now we've got everything on disk, and we've got everything backed up on hard copy. And now we're doing what? Entering more and more data, because now we can do more things with that data. And so then we have to have more copies and more paperwork, don't we? It's just more and more and more and more. So we have all these time-saving technologies supposed to save us from the dictates of the clock. And yet what's happening is this. We were supposed to have all this increased leisure, but it seems to have created more and more things for us to do. That's the world we live in today. A world chopped into tiny time segments. A world filled with commitments and schedules and plans. And we're overwhelmed by it all, I think, in many cases. We have so many appointments that we seem to be having trouble keeping, and so many commitments, and so many schedules and things to meet. And you know what? It's all going so incredibly fast. Jeremy Rifkin wrote a book called Time Wars. In it, he wrote this about America and our way of life. Every society has its own unique tempo, and nothing so captures the American tempo as the word speed. We're a nation in love with speed. We drive fast, eat fast, make love fast. We're obsessed with breaking records and shortening time spans. We digest our life, condense our experiences, and compress our thoughts. We're a culture surrounded by memos and commercials, and while other cultures might believe that haste makes waste, we're convinced that speed reflects alertness, power, and success. Americans, he says, are always in a hurry. And I agree. This is, I think, an apt way to describe our society today. Makes a valid point. But I want us to think about this for a moment. It wasn't always this way, that the way God created the world for us to live in was one in which we would be tied intimately to the seasons, that they would come and go throughout the year. There would be a weekly cycle. The sun would rise in the morning, and the sun would rise or set in the evening. And that's what God created us to live by, seasonal things like this. But what's happened is it's all been changed. There's been inventions. The time clock, for instance. George Woodstock said this: it's a frequent circumstance of history that a culture or civilization develops a device that will later be used for its destruction. And they make a case for the time clock being such a thing. It all began with the Benedictine order of monks. They were founded in the 6th century. They were a people who believed that all time belonged to God. And they dedicated themselves to fulfilling every moment with activities that would glorify God. And so they began to make schedules, you see, so they would all pray at a certain time. And they had one of the monks, and his job was to ring a bell when it's time to pray, then ring another bell when it was time to eat, ring another bell when it was time to go to work. Eventually, it got so complicated and so detailed that they actually rang bells for when you could take care of bodily functions. But it was a Benedictine monk that invented the time clock. And so what happened then is life actually forever changed from just living from sunrise to sunset. We became a people obsessed with schedules after this. The invention was an event that took place that changed our whole life, because now time could be looked at in terms of abstract numbers. It could be quantified, and certain things had to be done in a certain amount of time. And you know what happened, of course. It changed incredibly the perspective in life. And that now the merchants and industry seized upon the mechanical clock and schedules with a vengeance, because now you could control time, and time became money. And so a whole new meaning developed. The medieval period was one back in that time of history when people didn't look at time the way we do now. They would think nothing of taking off, just closing their shop, going to do something. Remember in the case of Jesus Christ there, when 5,000 people would just close up shop, they just follow him, take the day off. We can't think of doing things like that today, because we're so attached, so welded to our schedules. So anyway, this clock orientation changed everything, and a whole new value developed, and it was this: efficiency. That there was this new value in our society of becoming efficient, that you could be more quick, you could get things done faster, and you could make more money as a result of it. And so Winslow Taylor was the father of time management in the 1800s. He worked with, I think it was, yeah, Bethlehem Steel. And he studied the people there. And what he found out was he could study their actions, and he could shorten some of these things. As these people would load the packages onto freight cars, he saw that there was a lot of waste of time. And so he actually was able to double the production in Bethlehem Steel by just calculating how much time people took to do things. And that way he could speed things up. And it got more sophisticated. Later on, they began to film people and make calculations. Today, you know that there are people whose job it is to watch controls and gauges and meters and things like that. They actually have people now who will read your eyes to see how much time you're wasting in eye movements. But you understand what happened to industry? The individual, instead of going to do a job, now became an individual who simply had to park their brains at the door. They no longer were invested in it. Other people would make decisions for them about how to do things and how not to do them. And so they lost all their interest in their job. Life became just somebody tied to an assembly line. I remember when I was in the Navy, there was this example, and this lieutenant was telling me about a business that he had started, and I was really horrified. But he was so proud of this business. And what it was he had a business where people would go clean schools, and he had designed a cart. And now the individual, the janitor, would go into the classroom, and he would go a certain way in a certain path for every room. He would erase the blackboard, and then he would vacuum half of the floor. You didn't do the whole floor, because he would do that in the next one. You see, next pass would be tomorrow. You could get away with only doing half the floor one day and do another half later. So he was being able to go into a school. He could actually reduce the cost of your janitorial service by half. But think of what it's like for the janitor. You never get to see a completed job. You never get to go in and go, it looks good now. It looks right. It's just always half done, always in a state of half done. And so you get the idea of what I'm getting at. Is look at the quality of life. Look what happened to it, because of this kind of development in our thinking. So we created all these technologies, and I think that the time-saving technologies have reached a point in our life where we've made a major breakthrough in our generation that is still working to change our entire world. And that's the computer. Think about this for a minute. It went from a clock to a computer. And so in a couple of decades, the computer has invaded our life. And we went from measuring, you understand, when they made the first clock, they measured hours, didn't they? Then someone said, hey, let's put a minute hand on this. Okay, and then they got a minute hand on the clock. And then they said, well, now what we'll do is we'll put a second hand on the clock. And so I think it was only about 100 or so years ago that we had a second hand on the clock, but look what we've done now. We've got computers that measure time in nanoseconds, a millionth of a second. And so now what are we looking for all the time? Faster machines, aren't we? Faster machines. We've generated a whole society that wants to be able to enter data so that somebody can push a button and get the information they want. We've got a whole society now that wants to go and have dinner, and we just want to push a button on a machine and eat the dinner that comes out. But everything is becoming something we want, instantaneous gratification. We're moving in a direction, and that's why the individual wrote earlier, where what we thought might save our society and build our society could actually come to destroy our society, because people are getting to the point where they say in sociological circles that it's harder and harder to relate to people, because people don't want tangential discussions anymore. They want yes-no answers. They want people who are just going to give them this information, only the information they need and only when they want it. People are now getting to the point where they can multitask. That is, individuals now will go down a hallway, they'll meet someone, they'll be talking to someone as they go down the hallway, they just stop that conversation, start this conversation, stop that conversation, pick the other one up, like this one never happened. And we're moving so fast, thinking so fast, making decisions so fast, and all of this is necessary to make more and more and more money. But I think it's really hurting the quality of our life. So anyway, one of the latest developments is, of course, the tape machine. It's a fascinating thing what they've done. I don't know if you've seen this, but now they make a tape machine where they use a computer chip inside the tape recorder, and what it does is it actually clips off one tiny tenth of a second of each sound. And then what it does is it speeds it up, and then they, through the computer chip, stretch the word, and so you can actually listen to a 60-minute tape in 30 minutes. And we're doing this because everybody's so crowded for time. But the quality, again, the quality, you understand, you're not able to listen to the passion. You're not able to hear the mood. You're not able to get anything. You're not making contact with the individual. And so we're living in a world today, that is, it's giving the tape, living in a world today where people are having relationships with machines instead of other human beings. And you see this, don't you? With the kids playing the computer games right now, you do business over the computer. People have sex over the computer. Please think about what we have done in our society today as we speed things up ever faster and faster and faster. And so psychologists warn that we're losing a skill that allows us to relate to others intimately in life because of these time-saving devices. And so I say this, it's happening that our time-saving devices are actually causing us to squeeze out God. Let's go to Ephesians 5. I say that this hasn't happened by accident. It has not happened to us by accident. That there is a devil at work, and I think one of the things that he has done is cause life to be so speeded up that we're so distracted by schedules and so distracted by things that we have to do that are immediate, that are urgent. And there is this phrase called the tyranny of the urgent in a little booklet that someone wrote that I think is so appropriate for our day and our age today. The tyranny of the urgent. We had Bible study last night. We were actually giving the prayer for the Bible study, and the phone rang. And so somebody got up to answer the phone. But you understand how crazy it has become in our life? The phone has so much power over us. People will stop loving one another. People will, in the middle of a prayer, get up and go answer the phone. It's amazing. But our devices have caused a lot of this to happen to us. But I say this, that life has been speeded up to a point that it has so that we would lose perspective, so that we would become distracted from those things that are important, and schedules and those kinds of things would make demands on us that would just keep us from God. Ephesians 5 and verse 15. It says this, "See then that we live in this world, that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time, because the days are evil." And so I want today to make some points to remind you and remind myself, because of the past couple of weeks I've been through with very hectic schedules, that we need to use time to redeem the time. And it's something that each one of us only has so much time on this earth. The President of the United States has 24 hours a day, and the criminal in a jail cell has 24 hours a day, and the man out, the homeless man, has 24 hours a day. Each one of us has the same kind, the same amount of time, and you can't withdraw it back. People have said that time is money, but of course, go over to Psalm 90, time isn't money. Time is our life. And that you can deposit money in a bank, you can go back and draw it out, but you can't do that with time at all. Now, Psalm 90 was written by Moses, thought to be written just before his death, and he's considering some of these things, some of these concepts. And he's looking at the shortness of human life. An entire generation had passed, 40 years had been wandering in the wilderness, and now it was coming to a close for him. In that context, he wrote this in verse 1 and 2. "Lord, you've been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, wherever you had formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God." And so time doesn't affect God, but it certainly does us. Each generation that comes along finds God exactly the same. He changes not. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. And so in verse 4 is the verse that Peter actually quotes in 2 Peter that we began with. "For 1,000 years in your sight are but as yesterday when it's past, and as a watch in the night." In verse 5 and 6, "You carry them away as with a flood. They're as asleep in the morning, they are like the grass which grows up." That is human beings, our lives. "In the morning it flourishes and grows up, and in the evening it's cut down and it withers." And then in verse 10, "The days of our years are 80 years and 10. And if by reason of strength they be 80 years, yet it's their strength, labor, and sorrow, for it is soon cut off, and we fly away." And so we live 70 years, 80 years if we're strong. And of course, Anne, as we got to know her, lived to be in her mid-80s before she died. But we're like the dust then. We're just blown away. And our life is so short. Verse 12, it says this, "So teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts to wisdom." Number our days. Count them up. We don't have that much. Look at the time we do have, and use the time that we have to the most effective way that we can. And so I remind us of a second point here. Realize, of course, first that time is important and precious, but secondarily realize this. We get the most out of life if we will schedule our time. It's, I think, the best way to redeem it. That is to write down those things on a list that are the most important and do those things that are most important first, while you'll make so much better use of your time over a lifetime. That there's a principle in life called the 80-20 principle, that 80% of your success in life will come from 20% of what you do. And while I agree with this in principle, that is, I see it working in business where sometimes they'll only work with clients that they know they're going to get the big accounts. I would disagree with that, because sometimes the small ones will lead you to the big ones. I think that in business we should give the same attention to everybody who's a customer, for instance. But the principle still applies, that in your lifetime, that 80% of your success is going to come from 20% generally. That is, we do a lot of things throughout a day. Most of our success will only come from certain things that were the important things we did that day. Wouldn't it be worthwhile to realize what those things are and really think about that and really put ourselves into those things? And I say this, in all honesty, the most single most important thing we do in our life is our contact with God. And that's why everything's speeded up, to push that out so that we get up and we don't have time to pray. So we've got to get to work so we can give God a short prayer as we're going out the door, and sort of we think of God and we think we've done something all right. But we're not building a real lasting, not an intimate relationship, because it, what takes what? Doesn't it take time to build relationships with friends? Doesn't it take time to build relationships in marriage? Yes. And so doesn't it take time to build a relationship with God? Yes. Here's a third point that I think is just invaluable in life. So worth remembering. Do those things that you don't want to do first. Remember, this is the key to getting my kids to eat their vegetables, that I would give them the vegetables had to be eaten first. The thing they didn't like, if they didn't like spinach, they were to eat that first, and then we have dessert last. And that's the way we could get the kids, they would always get through it that way. But if we just didn't say anything, you understand what would happen. The vegetables sit there, and then they get around, everything would be eaten up, and now they're going to pick at those vegetables for almost an eternity. Well, Joe was a guy who did patios, and he was really good at it, and he liked his job. I mean, he was a physical kind of guy, and he liked the way the hammer felt, and he liked the way his muscle felt. And when he did a job, it was the best a job could be done. He did a very good job. But there was one part he didn't like about building patios, and the job was canvassing to try to get new customers. He hated the rejection. Yeah, you go, you get 1 in 10. Generally, as a salesman, I could get 1 in 10. But you know what that means? 9 times people are telling me they don't want me. 9 times I'm having to face somebody saying no and slamming the door or whatever. And so the point was this. He'd go ahead and he'd work and he'd get his work cleaned up, and then he wouldn't have any more work. And then he'd go back and look for more work. So he was always on the edge financially. So he went to a consultant and asked him what he could do to better his business. The consultant told him this. You do the thing you hate to do first. And so then he learned this lesson. He still hated it. But what he did was he would go out canvassing a certain part of every day. He would do that first before he went and worked on jobs. And that way he kept a list of jobs coming in all the time, you see. And it made the whole difference. And so he was finally able to be successful because of it. And so I remind us of this very same thing in life. It's so valuable to do the thing that you hate the most first. It's a good principle. Yeah. Here's a fourth point. Work wholeheartedly to make the best use of your time. There are people in life that you've probably seen them. Their whole goal in life is just to have fun, isn't it? Just to have fun. I remember when we were young, that was a lot of, yeah, right, okay, I was that age too. I know what it was like, yeah. Having fun was the primary goal in life, and so that's what I spent my time trying to do. And then you've probably seen other people in life that are going along waiting for that break, waiting to be seen, waiting to be recognized, waiting for somehow that big break in life to come in, maybe an investment that's going to really be big. And they wait for something rather than actively pursuing what is going to make it happen. And so the point is that it's so important to make the best use of your time. Richard Evans wrote this, some of us persist in waiting so chronically, he says, that youth slips by, opportunities slip by, and life slips by, finding us still waiting for something that really has been going on all the time. We just weren't a part of it. So he's saying that we should be a part of it. This is our time. This is our day, our generation. Not some golden age in the past, not some utopia in the future. This is it. Whether we're thrilled or disappointed, busy or bored, this is life, and it's passing. And he says, what are we waiting for? If we want something in life, we should go for it, shouldn't we? If we want a relationship with God, if we want the kingdom of God, shouldn't we give it everything we have? Shouldn't we pour ourselves into it? Yes. Yes. And there are people that are going to let the kingdom of God slip by. And they're going to do it because they just didn't think they needed to overcome. They thought they were okay. They can just drift on into the kingdom. God will take care of it for me, and it can slip through our fingers if we don't give it the kind of attention. So it says this in Ecclesiastes, whatsoever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. So if you're at work, you do your job at work with all your might. If you're raising your children, you do it with all your might. If you're working at a relationship in a marriage, we do it with all of our might. But the single most important thing, the 20% of our time, if you will, that is going to give us the 80% of the success in life is going to be working on a relationship with our God. And we should do that with all of our might. And so many times I've known, honestly, through my lifetime, of people that they put their Bible, after Sabbath services, they put their Bible in their briefcase. And then they open that briefcase and take their Bible out the next week when they come to services. Do you understand what's happening then? We're not applying ourselves. And if we do that, I think we're fooling ourselves. What we desire so much can slip right through our fingers. We're taken up with meetings. We're taken up with phone calls. We're taken up with fixing things, with cleaning our VCR, with defragmenting the computer. Taken up with all those things, and the really valuable thing somehow slips past us. This is a valid point in life. Give life our best. Life will give us back its best. Give God our best, and He'll give us what? His best in the kingdom of God. Another point is this. You go over to Colossians 4. Use otherwise wasted time. You've probably heard people in life talk about killing time. Well, that's something we don't want to do. What are you doing? Well, I'm just killing time. And in our world today, because it's so speeded up, I say we should never kill time. God says that we're to redeem it. But I bet this, if we were to actually see, and I consider myself fairly active and fairly busy, but if there was a record kept that I could see at the end of a year of how much time I actually wasted, I bet I'd be surprised. I'd probably be shocked about it if I actually could see this. But my point is this, we are to recapture, redeem the time, it says. So I know there are people here that have long drives. I had long drives at work. I used to do 250 miles a day. And I was listening to tapes, or I was at least meditating, thinking about things. My son, he used to go out to Loma Linda University, out through 138, made that drive twice a day, and I worked with him on this. The thing is, get some 3x5 cards, or in his case, you can actually review. You understand? Have you ever done this where you just go through, okay, how much of the Bible do I really know? Genesis 1, what do I know? Bang, 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 bang. Genesis 2, oh, that's where immortal soul is, right? Genesis 6, okay, what's there? Genesis 9, Genesis 12, where's Abraham at? Genesis 12, right? Then Isaac 25, and then you see what I'm saying? You can actually do this and develop a knowledge of the Bible. And there was one point, I'm kind of sloppy now because I'm not driving as much, in all honesty, but there was a time when I probably knew over 800 to 1,000 scriptures in my mind. And now that I don't have much of a mind, I'm getting older, I don't have that. But my point is this, you understand what I'm saying, is that there are places where if we go to a waiting room, should we just wait? Or should we bring something to study, bring something to read? That's my point today. And I'll say this, it's so valuable to do this. Redeem the time, Colossians 4. Colossians 4 and verse 5 says, walk in wisdom towards them that are without, that is, those outside. Redeeming the time. Don't kill time, but redeem it. Now listen, I don't mean to say this either, because here's another mistake. Many people can think, okay, we all have to be a type A personality. Oh no, I'm not saying that at all. You understand, I see a picture of Jesus who wasn't an individual who was just rushed and always pushed and always in a hurry. You don't see that, do you? But I think he was doing what needed to be done. And he was doing what needed to be done when it needed to be done. And he didn't have, I mean, he wasn't someone who had no deadlines. He knew there was a deadline, Passover, the 14th, right? And that time was coming, and we're reading about it now in our reading. And he had a deadline, and the work had to be finished, and he said, "It is finished." He had done it. He didn't leave part of it undone. It wasn't done sloppily. There wasn't a whole bunch of prophecies that didn't get fulfilled. Every one was done, wasn't it? But he wasn't a type A, just frantic and having a nervous breakdown and driving everybody else crazy because every second had to be filled. And so I bring this point out too. A sixth point is this. You know, if you really want to use time properly, and I'm convinced of this, I haven't always done it, and I'm reconvincing, reminding myself of this, it's important to schedule in time to rejuvenate yourself. Matthew 14. So much that is urgent, so much of our schedules demand so much time that we have no life for ourselves. We tend to think then sometimes that this is a highly desired state. Being efficient has become such a value in our society, but there's times where we need to just be inefficient. There's times where we just need to relax. There's times where we just need to be by ourselves. And even in driving, this is something that I experienced. I remember when I came out of college that I went to my company and asked them for a job, and they said, "Yeah, we'll give you a job. In fact, we got a place right here in Pasadena. We'd like you to fill that position." And so I thought, boy, that's great. I was living in Pasadena, and I thought I'll be 5 minutes from home. And you know what? I was. But you know what happened? After about 6 weeks or so, I was losing touch with myself. Because before, I'd had time to drive on my way home, at least a half hour, and I could think and meditate and reflect and put my life in some sort of order for myself. I could sort of see things, and I could analyze, you know, put things in perspective. But after a while, I began to lose that because I didn't have time just to be by myself. It's really vital. You know, the great inventions, the great ideas, they never come from people that are just so busy. They're doing this and that and this on their schedule and that on their schedule. You know where they come from? The great ideas, the ones that make the big money, the ones that solve the problems that you're experiencing in life, you know where they generally come from? When you're all alone. That's when you get insight about God, isn't it? When you're reflecting and meditating and you're alone and you go, oh, man, bang, a light comes on and you can see things. But if you're hurried all the time, if you don't take time to be by yourself and don't take time to just go off and meditate and reflect, you're so busy, you don't have time to think. You don't have time to put your life in perspective. And so you can be going and making great progress in the wrong direction because you need time to just reflect and think about it. So Jesus took the time over here in Matthew 14. In verse 22, there it says, "And straightway Jesus constrained his disciples to get into a ship and to go before him into the other side, while he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up to a mountain apart to pray. And when the evening was come, he was there alone." So we went through in the Bible study the four sides of Christ, and we saw that one of the sides of Christ was this symbolism of the ox, that he was a tireless worker, that he fed the 5,000, and people came up to him, and even when he was exhausted, and said, "Would you come and heal my son?" And he said, "Yes." And he went until he was tired as could be, even falling asleep in the ship during a storm. He just slept like a baby. He was so tired. But he realized the need to do this, and he sent the multitudes away. And he then went apart, alone, to pray. And so I remind us of this. You need to do the same thing. I know Jeanine was telling me in my own life, she was giving me some good advice, and I needed to go have some fun, to get out, to take and go to a movie, to go to dinner, and to have some fun, and not just work, 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 work. What does the saying makes Jack a dull boy? There's a valid point there about taking the time to spend with the ones that you love, whether it's your wife or your children or the great God whom we serve. And so understand that point. It's very valid. And so I say number seven, if you will, number seven, Ecclesiastes 12. Make sure, of course, that we spend time with God. There's coming a time when there won't be any more time. There's coming a time when it's going to be the end. I'm sorry, I said Ecclesiastes, didn't I? We'll get there, but I want to go to John first, if you would. John, sorry to throw that wrench at you. Make a left turn here, U-turn. Back here to John 12. John 12. And verse 35. Jesus said unto them, disciples, yet a little while is the light with you. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness come upon you. And he that walks in darkness knows not where he goes. There's a time coming, isn't there? A time coming when we're not going to be on television. A time coming where we're not going to be able to produce booklets. A time coming when they may not even let us meet here in peace. There's coming a very difficult time. We should then make use of all the time we have. Back now to Ecclesiastes 12, if you would. Do what we can now while we have the time. Remember in verse 1, your Creator in the days of your youth, while the evil days come not, nor the years draw not nigh, when you shall say, I have no pleasure in them. There's coming a time when we probably won't have the nice, neat little job we have, and the nice, neat little life that we have that's packaged with its schedules and with its televisions and computers. A time when perhaps we'll wish we could just defragment our computer. Sometime. We're living in a time that is the last era of the Church of God. And it's a time when people, it is said, would let down. It's when people would drift away. And so you understand my point? We're in a very unique time. What time is it? It's the time to kick it up a notch, as Marilyn would say. It's the time to put more effort into it than we've ever put in before, because we're so close to the end of the age. And so let's go to Romans 13. It's not a time to kick back and relax. It's not a time to be distracted by the world that has been created for us, that is going so fast with so many things to do. It's a time not to focus on our own comfort, not a time to just let down, but it is the time to put forth our best effort. Romans 13 and verse 11. Where it says this, and knowing that the time, that now it is high time to awake out of sleep, for now is our salvation nearer than when we believed. Think for a moment when that was said almost 2,000 years ago, right? Think how close we are today. And I think you can almost smell it. You watch the news, you can see what's happening. Europe is becoming stronger. The King of the South is forming, I believe, or in the process of forming. And so it is very close to the end. And let's conclude over here in Isaiah 40. Spend time with the Almighty God more and more as we draw to the close of the end of the age. To which we are anchored, and people's priorities are easily getting mixed up, distorted, perverted, as it were, and values are beginning to mirror, that is, in the Church of God, are beginning to mirror the values in the world. And we've seen that, haven't we? You must admit this is what's taking place all around the world. And so I come back to this. If we miss out, we could have wasted an entire lifetime. Wasted an entire lifetime. We mustn't do it. How much time are we spending in prayer every day? How much time are we spending in studying God's Word? Are we drifting? Don't let it happen if this is the case. It's more serious than anything else. It's more valuable, isn't it, than anything else? Think of anything. Is there anything more valuable than the kingdom of God and the goal God has set before us? No, I don't think so. But people can fool themselves thinking they don't have to actively pursue it. To spend effort and energy and time pursuing the kingdom. So I remind us that the life is a training ground here for all of us. a training ground to learn to be more and more like He is. That's what this world exists for. That's why out of all the chaos that's out there, all the dead planets, when you see the moon and you see Mars and you see Saturn and all the rest of it, they're nothing like us, are they? You remember the pictures from the moon and you see this beautiful blue orb filled, just teeming with life. This is our training ground created for us to use time, a lifetime, to learn to be more like God. And so Isaiah 40 says this. Isaiah 40 in verse 28. Have you not known? Have you not heard that the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, He faints not, neither is He ever weary. And there's no searching of His understanding. He gives power to the faint, and to them that have no might, He increases their strength. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and all the young men shall utterly fall. But they that wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary, and they shall walk and not faint. It says here that they that wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. And there's two meanings to this word. It's worth looking up. And the first meaning is this: to patiently wait. That is, there are cases in life where we want everything right now. We're living in an age where everything's insistent and urgent, and instant gratification is a way of life. But He's telling us, wait. Be patient and wait. I'm coming, and your reward is absolutely sure. But there's another aspect to wait, and it's this. And Randy understands this. That is to wait on tables. That is to serve God, you see, that it's not in active patience waiting for Him to come. It also includes, that is, that we are actively working in serving as we wait for Him to come. You see what I'm saying? This verse is telling us, use your time. Yes, we get tired. Yes, we get weary. God will strengthen us, and He will give us that end that He's promised. Let's work toward that with all of our being, and let's use the time God has given us to that end.